The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
We made it to a Friday. Congratulations to us. What a weird week this has been. You know, just when we think we're pulling out of the shit, we get pulled back in again. You know, today we are seeing the insanity of some of the elected members of Congress. You know, I used to think that at least the people that we've elected to represent us in Congress, even if they're not necessarily the ones that I voted for, at least there's, you know, sanity there. There are adults there. Well, that is not the case anymore. There's just so much crap that has gone on in Congress, and it's mostly from these new members who just do not know how to behave like civilized adults. And you know where I'm going with this, right? The whole kerfuffle between Marjorie Taylor Greene, well, and everybody else. She's just a horrible excuse for a human being. But it's not only her. I saw a tweet today from Eric Swalwell, and Eric Swalwell is like the nicest, easygoing guy. But I guess you don't want to fuck with him, because he tweeted 5 hours ago today, or earlier today, "I had a mask on as I stepped off the floor. An aide with Marjorie Taylor Greene yelled at me to take my mask off. No one should be bullied for wearing a mask. So I told the bully what I thought of his order. Predictably, he went speechless. I regret that I wasn't more explicit." Well, somebody named Scott Wong. Who is Scott Wong? He's with The Hill. He's a reporter with The Hill. Okay, so he wrote, "Representative Swalwell responds." And he quoted him. Well, actually, now I'm not finding it. Okay, so then Scott Wong tweeted what happened. Marjorie Taylor Greene's spokesman, Nick Dyer, told Congressman Swalwell, "Biden says you can take off your mask." Swalwell confronted Dyer, got in his face, and according to Dyer, said, "You don't tell me what to fucking do." Now, I don't know, you know, what happened, but Eric Swalwell is standing up, and you have to stand up to these bullies. You just have to. So today we hear that Marjorie Taylor Greene accosted AOC. I think we heard about this yesterday, right? She was chasing her down the hallway, screaming, "Alexandria, Alexandria, come and debate me." First of all, nobody calls her Alexandria. Apparently, she goes by Sandy. Just in case you were wondering, I don't know. I've never met her, but she calls Alexandria. And then, AOC, let me see if I can't find this clip, because it was really good. Somebody asked her about, and now I can't find it, of course. I just had it here a moment ago. What happened with her? And she basically said, "Look, that woman has issues. She's sick." Here we go. Here's the clip. And I might even be able to bring up video. Look at this. I'm so high tech. All right. So here's AOC, face mask on and everything. And a reporter, asked her about what happened with her run-in with Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Yeah, it seems as though she had been posting some video. I mean, this is a woman that's deeply unwell.
You can't really hear it. There's noise.
And clearly needs some help.
This is a woman that's deeply unwell and clearly needs some help. And if you don't think so, then you just don't know Marjorie like we know Marjorie. So Andrew Kaczynski is known as the K-File at CNN. And Andrew Kaczynski keeps track of all this crap. And Andrew Kaczynski kept a copy of a since-deleted video that Marjorie Taylor Greene made back in 2019, obviously before she somehow wormed her way into Congress. And so Andrew Kaczynski today posted it. Marjorie Taylor Greene had deleted it. And this is from 2019. The entire video runs, I want to say, like close to an hour. This is just a short clip of it. And it shows her walking through the halls of Congress, like, you know, harassing members, going to different offices and giving them a hard time. And you know what? You can, well, at least pre-COVID, you could walk through the Capitol, not like they did on January 6th, but, you know, in a civilized manner. And you can visit different members' offices. But apparently they were making so much noise this day and harassing so many staffers that some of the staffers locked their doors, including AOC. So where we pick up this video that Andrew Kaczynski, K-File, just posted on Twitter, they're standing outside AOC's house door, and they're harassing the staffers through the mail slot, in the door. And here's just a little bit of what they did that day.
You want to talk to Crazy Ocasio? You come to this little thing and you open it up and you whisper
Crazy
into
Ocasio.
Her. This is confession. This is Ocasio confession right there.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I'm an American citizen.
Oh
I pay
God.
Your salary through the taxes that you collect from me through the IRS. Because I'm a taxpaying citizen of the United States. I'm a woman. I'm a female business
A woman and
owner,
a female. Oh.
And I'm proud to be an American woman. And I
proud
do not support your socialist policies. And I do not support your murderous abortion policies. As a mother of three children, I'm appalled at New York's law for abortion. And it needs to end and it needs to stop now.
Oh my
You're bringing
God.
God's judgment on our country. And I'm against it as well as my friends. So you need to stop being a baby and stop locking your door and come out and face the American citizens that you serve. If you want to be a big girl, you need to get rid of your diaper and come out and be able to talk to the American citizens instead of us having to use a flap, a little flap.
It's kind of like hers. It's kind
sad.
Of
Okay, that's enough of that. Now, it goes on from there, but I think we've heard enough. In fact, hey, Marjorie. We, everyone here at the Nicole Sandler Show, has a little song for you.
I just need you to shut the fuck up, cause nobody asked you, bitch. I need you to shut the fuck up, bitch, shut the fuck up, bitch. Just shut the fuck up, bitch, shut the fuck up, bitch. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up, shut the fuck up. Bow, bow, shut the fuck up,
shut the fuck up, bow, bow. Shut the fuck up. Shut the fuck up. How that woman ever got elected to Congress, I was going to say eludes me, but it doesn't. Because so much of this nation has been brainwashed. It's just the crazy. It's opposite world. And we're further deep down that rabbit hole than we've ever been before.
Everything you thought you knew, you never knew it all. Sideways is straight ahead. Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
And it's on every front because these crazies, I mean, you heard the other day about the, I played you clips for the last 2 days from the hearing just the other day on what happened on January 6th. And we heard a slew of Republican members of Congress lying. Lying to Congress is a crime. Lying as a member of Congress should also be a crime. But they do it. They do it with just blatant nose thumbingness. You know, they just don't care. So I got to credit David Cicilline. David Cicilline, Democratic congressman from Rhode Island, who is looking for co-sponsors for a resolution that he's introducing to censure three Republican representatives for their statements minimizing the violence of what happened on January 6th. Let's see, he's circulating a resolution to censure Representatives Heiss, Clyde and Gosar for their comments in the hearing the other day. So you want to know what Heiss, Gosar, and what was the other one? Clyde. Oh, yeah, Clyde was the worst of the bunch. What they said, hold on, I will pull those clips over for you. In fact, actually, where are they? Okay, here's Gosar. You know what? I have a longer clip of Gosar than I played the other day, just to show you how thick the crazy is with this one. Remember, Paul Gosar is from Arizona. He's the one who stood up and objected to the certification, and he was the lead guy from Arizona. He also is a dentist, and his siblings came forward when he first showed off his crazy and said, this man, he is our brother, but he's nuts, and he does not belong anywhere, anywhere near Congress. The people of Arizona reelected him. Go figure. But here's Paul Gosar. And I wish I had the video, but I don't. But Paul Gosar, when he's talking, he keeps moving back and forth. It's like he's got, like he's high on something and he can't sit still. And you can hear it in his voice because it wavers. But just listen, the crazy here runs really deep.
Madam Chairwoman, my constituents demand answers, but the truth is being censored and covered up. As a result, the DOJ is harassing peaceful patriots across the country.
Yeah, right.
Without accurate answers, conspiracies continue to form.
Oy.
Russia hoax promoter, riot enabler, and Washington State Representative Pramila Jayapal, who objected to
Pramila
the electors
Jayapal.
In 2016
Pramila
without
Jayapal.
The required support of a senator,
oh my God.
Filed an ethics complaint against me for the following for following the law under 3 U.S.C. Code
All right,
15, the electoral count.
I can't. I know. I was going to play it for you. I had all good intentions. You heard just the way he pronounced Pramila Jayapal's name, or mispronounced. These people do that on purpose. They mispronounce AOC's name. They mispronounce Pramila Jayapal's name. They mispronounce the vice president's name. It's Kamala Harris, like a comma with a la after it. Kamala. It's really easy. But they on purpose mispronounce it to show what? That they're assholes? Yeah. Okay, so that was Paul Gosar, who David Cicilline is introducing a resolution to censure. He also is going to censure Jody Tice. This is just a tiny little clip. It's about all I could stomach.
It was Trump supporters who lost their lives that day, not Trump supporters who were taking the lives of others.
Oh, please. I think he's also the guy who said that, or it could have been another one of these brain surgeons, that Ashley, what's her name? The woman who was shot dead while she was trying to go through the broken glass in the door that they had smashed out to get to the House chamber before she was shot and killed. They said she was executed and that the officer who killed her should be brought up on charges. He should be given the medal. He should be given a Medal of Valor for protecting our members of Congress from an armed insurrectionist who was trying to break in to do evil to them. And then just one more. This is the worst of the worst. This guy's name is Andrew Clyde. Remember this name, because he's the one who actually said this.
There was no insurrection, and to call it an insurrection, in my opinion, is a bold-faced lie. Watching the TV footage of those who entered the Capitol and walked through Statuary Hall showed people in an orderly fashion staying between the stanchions and ropes taking videos and pictures. You know, if you didn't know the TV footage was a video from January the 6th, you would actually think it was a normal tourist visit.
A normal tourist visit.
Facts no longer matter. Reality is now fiction. There's a signpost up ahead. Your next stop, opposite world.
Yeah. Boy, we are thick in it. These people are nuts. And that's what's frightening. So I got to tell you a couple of things. One is although I'm putting on a brave front, trying to remain optimistic, I'm light years better than I was while the orange one was sitting in the Oval Office, because frankly, I did not handle that well. So Joe Biden's in there. not perfect, but he's doing a whole lot better than I expected he would. Although I still have some problems with him. I'm not thrilled with the way he has spoken on what's happening in Israel right now. He said that he doesn't think Israel is overreacting. Really? I'm not going to go into great detail on this today. We may get further into it next week. But the fact that Israel is war. It's getting really, really bad. Israel dramatically escalated its assault on the Gaza Strip early today with a combined air and artillery barrage targeting the tunnel system below the streets of Gaza, likely including significant civilian casualties. Israel deployed ground forces, though they're denying that they actually entered Gaza. We heard reports that they did. We do know that the Israeli military claims that Gaza militants fired at least 55 rockets towards Israel overnight, bringing the total to about 1,800. Two women in Israel died after falling while running for shelter, bringing the total number of people killed in Israel to 8 civilians and 1 soldier. On the other side, Gaza's health ministry reported the death toll there climbed to at least 119, including 31 children and 830 people wounded. If you think that's equal response, then you're wrong. And maybe the thing, this all started because Israelis were again evacuating Palestinian families from their homes, this time in a neighborhood called Sheikh Jarrah. It's a neighborhood in East Jerusalem where they have been for generations. And they are evicting them to install far-right Israeli settlements. I'm sorry, that's wrong. There's so much wrong there, and I can't cover it now, but I had to say that. And Joe Biden said he doesn't see any signs that Israel is overreacting. And Netanyahu, yes, Diane Russell in the chat in YouTube said, guess Netanyahu thinks if he starts a war, they won't convict him. Not only that, they won't oust him from office. You see, there's supposed to be another government coming in and taking over. Netanyahu lost the election 3 times, or is it 4 times in a row? So another one of the parties was tasked with trying to form a government because Netanyahu couldn't put together a coalition. Well, now that hostilities have started again, the other guy, and pardon me for not knowing the name of the different factions. I try not to think too much about the hardliners in Israel. But they said, you know what? We're not going to deal with this. Let Netanyahu keep on and you know, run roughshod over this war, you know, do what he does best, kill people, and you know, we'll talk after that. It's fucked up. As bad as things are here, they just do not have their shit together on that front in Israel, because Netanyahu should have been long gone from government, but he's still there. Go figure. I can't make sense of it. Okay, so had to get that out of the way. I'm going to leave that there. We may come back to it next week, but it's Friday. And I was going to say I want to lighten things up, but I actually have kind of a heavy guest coming up. It's a serious subject, but I think it's one that needs to be talked about. But today, being Friday, we're going to have a little overtime segment. So just warning you now, this program usually ends, it's an hour long. We're on weekdays from 5 to 6 p.m. Eastern, 2 to 3 Pacific. We're on live on the Progressive Voices Network. We stream live to YouTube, we're back, Facebook, Twitch, and Twitter. And then the show is available as a podcast, and you know, you can get it any one of a number of ways. You can subscribe to the audio podcast. It's always free. We live off your donations, but it's free for everybody because I know not everyone can afford to pay for a podcast. Or you can watch the video, but it's usually an hour long. Every now and then I do an extra segment. Today is one of those days because I told you yesterday that I was going to speak with Rick Allen of the drummer of Def Leppard. Now, I'm a music nut, but I'm not a hard rock fan. Never was a Def Leppard fan. And when I was offered him, I thought, you know, I would normally say no, but his story is fascinating because he's the guy who was this major rock star drummer, got into a car accident, and his left arm was severed. He lost his arm. Now he's a one-armed drummer. And he tells the story. He'll tell the story because we taped this a little while ago. That friend of his built a custom set for him that allows him to play the drum with his right hand and his left foot. Wasn't that a movie, My Left Foot? Anyway, if you stick around after the regular part of the show, we'll end as usual at 6 o'clock. That's when we leave the Progressive Voices Network. But we're going to stay on the air, and I'm going to share with you the interview I did with Rick Allen, because I thought it was fascinating. And the reason we're talking is because he is an artist, and he's got a showing, actually three of them, here in South Florida next weekend. But you don't have to be in South Florida to see it because he's got a website. So it was an interesting conversation. So I invite you to stick around after the regular part of the show for overtime. And if you are listening on Progressive Voices, you can come over. There's lots of other ways to hear the overtime portion of the program. You can just come to NicoleSandler.com/listen-live and click on my player there. You could just go to NicoleSandlerStream.com and get the audio, or you can come to our YouTube channel or Facebook or Twitter or Twitch, because there is video. So lots of ways. And then it'll also be shared afterwards. So if you don't want to listen live, listen at your leisure, whatever. Our guest is the author of a book called Facing the Mountain. And I'm not going to tell you too much now because he'll be joining us in about 10 minutes. And I'll let him tell you what it's all about. But the reason that I booked him is because of what we're going through now. And I am of the mind that history does repeat itself. We make the same mistakes over and over again. Hopefully, sometimes we learn from those mistakes. Unfortunately, we don't always. And when we don't learn from them, part of the blame can go to the fact that this country tries to sweep the ugly under the rug. So this book today, Facing the Mountain, the subtitle is A True Story of Japanese American Heroes in World War II. Well, to be honest with you, when I was a kid, when I was, Hernan in the chat room says, Nicole, might you try to go see the art show in person? Yes. The art show's in three places this weekend. It's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, next weekend, not this weekend, in Boca Raton, on Los Olas Boulevard in Fort Lauderdale, and at the Hard Rock in Hollywood. I'm not sure which one we'll go to, but we're going to try to go to one of them. I'd love to meet him in person because we had a great conversation. So anyway, there's that. Back to this. I know I should sometimes just ignore the questions. In school, and I was an okay student. I mean, I wasn't a great student, but I was an okay student. I studied history. Never once in high school or college was I ever taught that America, that the United States, put Japanese Americans in internment camps in World War II. I did not know. I was never taught that in school. Never. I learned that many years later on my own when I read something. I'm like, what are you talking about putting Japanese in concentration camps in America? We didn't do that. Yeah, we did. So I figured that today, with all these open hostilities against Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, here we go again. To quote the Propeller Heads featuring Shirley Bassey, if I could play music, I would, because they joined forces for It's All Just a Little Bit of History Repeating. And we need to learn from our life lessons and not repeat those lessons, not repeat the same mistakes. And we just do it over and over again. So anyway, in a few minutes, we'll talk with Daniel James Brown. And I think we're all going to learn about some ugly American history. All right. But before we do that, I thought we need to lighten things up again. I'm trying to figure out which one I should play for you, though. You know what? We're going to get off the, so to speak, the subject of everything. We're going to get off serious stuff, and I'm going to play for you one of the song parodyists that I discovered during the pandemic. Because Shirley Chirbon, first of all, I found her song parody. She did a lot of COVID stuff. This is the school principal in New Zealand who, during the lockdown, started doing these videos. And they were mostly COVID-related. Well, the one I'm going to play for you right now is not about COVID. But if you're a woman of a certain age, and I know a lot of the women in the chat room are, you know, a similar age. I'm 61, so I know of what she's singing here. You will relate. And even if you're not there yet, listen carefully because you will be soon. So take it away, Shirley Chirbon of New Zealand. Well, you'll hear. Here we go. I got to start it over here. Here we go.
Is this my new life? Irritability.
Uh-oh. Hold on.
Shutting down inside.
You know what? I'm not going to play that version for you because you can't see the video. Oh, there it goes. All right. Now I'm going to play it for you. Sorry. I'm going to start it over. I didn't realize it started that way. Best laid plans and all that stuff. All right. Take two. Shirley Chirbon, take it away.
Is this my new life? Irritability. Shutting down inside. I can't sleep and so is she. Got sweaty thighs. This is my demise, you see. I'm just a flush comes, memory goes, mood is high, then it's low. Every day more hair grows where I don't want any to be. Poor me.
You feeling it yet?
Mama, it's menopause. Children can be bred. Now my ovaries are dead. Mama, no, it's not much fun. I once was hot in quite a different way. Drama, ooh. Don't know it. Remember my plans for tomorrow, and my drive has all gone. My brain is feeling scattered. Spine, body's aching all the time. Good night, no, I won't sleep. Just got to go. Gonna toss and turn and pee the whole night through. Sauna, ooh.
Where do I stand go?
I'm all cracked and dry. I can't stand here. Hot potato, yes I am.
A hot flush in the shush, go and open the windows. Thunderbolts and lightning, don't cross me on frightening sea.
Just a mail.
All I say, oh,
do
or you'll pay, oh.
Don't delay, oh, don't you know
I'm gonna blow. I'm just a poor girl with
a hot body.
She's just a poor girl, nauseous and clammy. Just give her chocolates and wine, let her be.
Magnesium for the bones, more pills for my hormones.
Hot flush.
No,
we will not let you go.
Let
this
me go.
Attic. We will not let you go.
Let
this
me go.
Mood swing. We will not let you go.
Let me go.
We'll not let you go.
Let me go.
We'll not let you go.
Let me go.
Menopause,
menopause,
menopause. Just let me go. This hellish cup turns a woman into wild banshees. Banshees, banshees.
So you think you can stop age and turn back time? So you think that your fountain of youth won't run dry? Oh, ladies, take it from me. Your time will soon come, be battering me. At least no more and flow.
At least no more and flow. That is Shirley Sherbon. She is an elementary school principal, actually, in New Zealand. And that is this is what she did during the pandemic. She made these funny song parodies, mostly dealing with our condition, mostly dealing with what we went through with COVID, or, you know, still are going through with COVID. And that was the first song parody that I've heard of hers that wasn't that. And I thought we could use a little break because we are going to get into a kind of a heavy subject next. And to the men who didn't get it, sorry, you've not lived through menopause. Lighten up. It can't be all serious and doom and gloom because we'll commit suicide. We need to laugh. You need to find diversions that are not all politics, that are not all things that are going to make your head explode. And if you can't laugh, then you got nothing. Okay? So I wanted to have a sort of a palate cleanser in there after my outrage over, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene and our next guest, who we're going to talk to right now. I'm very happy to welcome to the show Daniel James Brown. And I'm guessing, hi, Daniel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Nicole. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Do you go by James? And I'm asking because your Twitter handle is at D James Brown.
I go by Daniel.
You go by Daniel. I just thought maybe you put the D because James Brown, obviously, you know, there's a more famous James Brown out there.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, but so Daniel is the name you go by. At D James Brown, sure, is your Twitter handle. And the book that's just out is called Facing the Mountain, A True Story of Japanese American Heroes in World War II. And I got to tell you, the story you tell is such an important one for a number of reasons. And obviously it's timely now because, as I say, history repeats itself. And we're seeing just horrific treatment of Asian Americans. We're hearing almost every day of a story of an older Asian man or woman walking down the street and getting beaten up by somebody for no reason at all, other than perhaps the former orange occupant of the White House would call it the China flu. And things like that. So maybe people are taking it to this level and blaming people who appear Asian. It makes no sense. None of this makes any sense. But this is a good time to look back and see how this country has treated our Asian American citizens. And I got to tell, I told the listeners a little earlier that I'm almost embarrassed to say it, but I went through high school and college, took many history classes, and never learned in school that we had Japanese internment camps here in the United States, that we, during World War II, locked up Japanese American citizens. And it blows my mind. And reading the book, Facing the Mountain, you tell the story of four in particular who fought in World War II, the Japanese Americans, they were Americans, whose parents were immigrants, and who, while they were fighting for our country, in many cases, their parents and siblings were put in these internment camps, concentration camps. And this is a story that needs to be told. Again, I went through a very good education and never was taught that. Is that normal? I mean, do other people have that experience, or am I alone here?
I think it depends partly on where you grow up. I grew up in the Bay Area in California, so we did have some exposure to it. Actually, my family, my father was in the flower business, so we had many friends and customers in the florist and nursery business who were directly affected by what happened. So I was keenly aware of it, even as a child growing up.
Well, in the Bay Area, I could see, because there's a big, you know, Asian community there. And, you know, I went to elementary school in New York, but I went to high school and college in Florida. And that probably explains it all.
Yeah, I mean, it has always been something that's been much more more widely known on the West Coast. During World War II, the vast preponderance of Japanese Americans lived either in Hawaii or along the West Coast, and so, you know, the story is certainly better known out here. But I was astonished when I started working on this book and was talking to some of my publishing friends back east, actually, at how little they knew about the story. It actually surprised me.
Right. Okay. So I'm not alone. I mean, I felt, and I learned about this, you know, it's got to be 20 years ago now, but my God, I'm 61. I should have learned this in American history in high school, at least. So you're doing a great service here. And again, we need to tell these stories. And I understand, look, I'm in awe of FDR. This lessens him in my eyes. This is a big, you know, slash on his character. The fact that he could do this, I don't understand. You know, it's stories like this that might help us to understand what we do to our fellow human beings. But tell us about Facing the Mountain. You focus in on is it a regiment? I don't know the military, the 422nd Infantry Regiment. And when I was telling my husband that you were coming on the show, and I said, this is what this book is about, and it's the 422nd, he said, yeah, all Japanese Americans. He said, Daniel Inouye was part of that. It's like, yeah, he was. So my husband knows, thankfully. But now you're educating us. So tell us about this group and what made you decide to write this story?
Yeah, actually, it's the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. But it was an all Japanese American, originally a volunteer unit of the Army that was, well, actually, initially, right after Pearl Harbor, Japanese Americans were not allowed to enlist. So hundreds of thousands of them, young men, young Nisei men, second generation of men. Thousands, I should say, tried to enlist and were turned away. But in the spring of 1943, the Roosevelt administration reversed course and created this segregated Japanese American fighting unit that that went on to become one of the most decorated units of its size in American military history. So they were an extremely effective fighting force. But I got interested in this. In 2015, I met a gentleman named Tom Ikeda in Seattle. And Tom has for 25 years now been collecting, videotaping, and collecting the oral histories of Japanese Americans, mostly folks that lived through World War II era. And after I met Tom, these are all available on a website called Densho. dentro.org, I went home and I started looking at and listening to these oral histories, and I was just transfixed by some of the stories. They were the kinds of stories I'm drawn to anyway. They were the stories about really ordinary Americans confronting a really difficult situation. In this case, a great deal of prejudice and a number of related issues, and coming together and overcoming those obstacles and those challenges in really admirable ways. Those are the kinds of stories I'm always drawn to anyway. And I fell into that, and I began to talk to Tom, and I began to talk to the family members of some of these folks. And over the course of 5 years, it has evolved into this book.
Wow. Now you tell the story of the 442nd, sorry about that, and as a whole, but you also really zero in on four main characters, and you let us get to know them and their families, and you humanize them, which is so necessary because people are human beings. Each, you know, when I think of the sheer numbers of people who've died from COVID, and you think every one of those 560,000 or more, each one of those is a person, a human being with a family and a story. Well, so that's what you do here. So tell us a little bit about these four men.
Yeah, so that's what I do. I didn't want to write a history of Japanese Americans. That would be really presumptuous, right? I mean, for one thing. And it's not what I do. What I do is I find deeply personal stories that shed some light on an interesting slice of history. So working with Tom and the families, I wound up focusing on four young men, all of whom immediately after Pearl Harbor faced the same dilemma. Right after Pearl Harbor, Japanese American men of draft age had this problem. Their families were being taken away to these concentration camps. They were taken out of their schools. They were forced to leave behind their businesses. They were forced to sell their possessions for pennies on the dollar. And at the same time that millions of other young American men were signing up to fight for their country. And so it was this dilemma. What do you do if you're a draft age Japanese American man in early 1942?
Right.
So I picked three, four. One of them actually was a resistor, a young man named Gordon Hirabayashi, who defied there was a curfew in Seattle, an 8 p.m. curfew for Japanese Americans. He defied that. He refused to get on the bus when Japanese Americans were removed from Seattle, and instead turned himself into the FBI. And that began a court case that went on all the way to the Supreme Court. So that's one strand of the story. The other three are all young men that wound up signing up for the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. And you know, their stories are interrelated, but they're really also the stories of their families, their immigrant parents, their lives in these camps, in some cases, the actual fighting in the war, and then their lives afterwards, because when many of them came out of the camps and came home from the war, they still faced a great deal of prejudice and a lot of difficult times.
It's astounding. You're looking back on it today, but here we are, what, 80 years removed or something? I mean, we're getting up there. But it's all the more reason why we need to learn these stories and why our kids should learn them. And we don't teach enough, I think, acceptance with our history. And again, I go through my own. I had a good education, and not being told these stories, I think, is a big detriment, and perhaps a reason we're seeing this hostility today, because people aren't looking at others as the fully rounded human beings that they are.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I learned a lot in the course of writing this book. It was also, I mean, when I began to write this, as I was beginning to write this book, I was researching these hardworking immigrant families from Japan trying to make their way in America. At the same time that the Trump administration was spouting all this anti-immigrant rhetoric. And then I was reading about how the incarcerations in these camps tore families apart. at the same time that families were being torn apart on the southern border. And then I was reading about the kinds of racist rhetoric that arose right after Pearl Harbor, at the same time that we were seeing what's happened in the last few years here. So there have been, through the writing of this book, there's just been all these echoes with history that they haven't changed the facts of what I'm writing, but they certainly, I think they did cause me to bring certain things and certain themes forward in the book. It seemed really important to me to do that.
Right. Well, I'll tell you something. It's the reason why I wanted to talk with you about this book, because when I saw what it was about, I thought these are the stories we need to be telling right now. We need to teach about our differences and how they bring us together. I'm really curious about the men who enlisted. They volunteered to fight, and yet their parents and or siblings were put in these camps. How did they deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, imagine that. I should say, first of all, that there were sort of two camps among young Nisei men. There were those who very much resisted the idea of serving and actively resisted incarceration in the camps. But there was another contingent that thought, well, we're here, we're in these camps. When the war's over, what are people going to say about us? And so a certain contingent of them said, well, one thing we can do is we can join this new army unit and fight for the country, fight and die for the country. And, you know, quite a few of them, particularly large number from Hawaii, but also quite a few from the concentration camps on the West Coast, decided that was the way forward in order to sort of start changing the country's perception of them.
You know, a couple of weeks ago, I spoke with Senator Mazie Hirono, who also has a new book out called, it's right over there, Heart of Fire. And it's about, she was born in Fukushima, of all places, in Japan, and, you know, grew up with immigrant parents in Hawaii, most part. But, you know, again, the challenges that she faces, we don't hear a whole lot about Asian American stories. And I don't know if that has to do with the culture that they bring with them or our own prejudices. Is it, can you shine a light on that and why and understand why?
Yeah, I mean, as I say, I learned a lot about Asian American history in the course of researching this book. And I learned how deeply rooted it is in the American consciousness. You know, it goes back actually to the 1850s. The gold rush in California, there were a lot of Chinese immigrants who came to work in the gold fields and on the railroads that were being built in the West. And they were treated horribly. There were beatings and lynchings and burnings and people run out of town. And then by the late 19th century, there arose this notion of the yellow peril, which was this idea that hordes of Asians were going to be invading white countries like the United States and bringing pestilence and disease. And that was a very widespread notion around the turn of the century. And along with it came these images and these tropes of Asian Americans as insects and vermin and snakes and bringers of plague and things like that. And part of what I learned was that those images and tropes and notions, they have sort of stuck there in the American consciousness. As I said earlier, they came up again after Pearl Harbor. And I think we see them coming back up now when, you know, when President Trump says something like the Kung Flu or the China virus. He's playing on old stereotypes and old tropes that are, they're already there, you know, out in the American consciousness. So I think it's really, what I'm hoping this book will do is by meeting these four young men and their families and getting to understand where they came from and why they came and what they went through in their early lives and what they experienced during the war. My hope is that will make them relatable and I think making people comfortable with other people is one of the things a writer can do. So that's my real hope, is that by getting to know these particular four young men, maybe that will open some hearts that need some opening.
I hope so too. You had a lovely review in the Wall Street Journal that I hadn't seen, because I don't really read the Wall Street Journal, but you tweeted it out, and for some reason that wasn't behind the paywall, so congratulations on that. That was nice. And from what they said, it sounds like this should be made into a movie.
Yeah, actually there's some movement on that front. We've been talking to there's a young director named Destin Daniel Creighton. He made most recently a movie called Just Mercy, which was about a black civil rights lawyer and a death penalty case. Mm. And it's a remarkably good film. It's just so full of heart. And Destin's a person, he grew up in Hawaii. He's half Japanese American himself.
Perfect.
So he and I have been talking, and it looks like that might move forward. So I'm excited about that.
Oh, great. Because that's what you need we need these stories to get out into the mainstream America. We need people to stop hating on the others. And it's just so rampant here. I'm of Jewish heritage, and seeing some of the nonsense that they're still spewing out there, it just goes.
We watched what movie? Just Mercy.
Oh, Just Mercy. My husband's telling us we watched that movie.
Oh,
that was the lawyer in L.A. Okay, we did watch that movie. That was a great movie.
Yeah, well, I'm telling you, he's a great director.
Awesome. Cool.
And he's very excited to do this project. So,
glad to hear it. I want to ask about, what is it called, Densho? You talked about Tom Ikeda, who wrote the introduction to the book. And frankly, a lot of people write introductions to the book and don't get mentioned in interviews and in the promotional materials, don't get spotlighted. But you did. So tell us about Densho and who they are and what they do.
Yeah, so Densho is a wonderful organization. As I think I said, they've been doing this for 25 years. Tom and his staff have been collecting these oral histories, and they make them up, they curate them, they put them up on their densho.org, their website. So anybody can go in and listen to these firsthand accounts. They've also collected photographs and letters and many other supporting pieces of material, but really sort of the centerpiece are these recorded oral histories. Mm. And lately they've turned their attention more and more to sort of social justice action. Tom is very interested in, for instance, how the Japanese American experience relates to Muslim American experience.
Mm-hmm.
So they do a lot of social activism and try to use the history that they have accumulated to educate people about racism and systemic prejudice.
Good. Well, that's great. This sounds great. The book is Facing the Mountain, a true story of Japanese American heroes in World War II by Daniel James Brown, just released a couple of days ago. So congratulations. This is like you write books like this. Tell us some of the other books you've written.
Well, my most recent book, by far the most popular so far, is called The Boys in the Boat, which was about the University of Washington rowing crew that went to Hitler's Germany and defeated a very good rowing team, non-Nazi rowing team, in front of Hitler. It's ostensibly a story about rowing, but it actually is a story about, again, young men, ordinary young American men, coming together, pulling together, overcoming all kinds of extraordinary challenges and prevailing in the end.
Good stories with great lessons that we should be teaching our children. Daniel James Brown, thank you so much. I haven't read the book yet, but I look forward to doing so. And even more so seeing the movie because it sounds, you know, I hate to say it, that's how you reach the masses. And we need to hear these stories. I'm kind of heartened that in some of the TV shows that I watch, there's one called A Million Little Things. that is dealing with, you know, social justice issues. The episode last week or this week was about the George Floyd killing and the protests. And there's an Asian mother and son, and they deal with a lot of these kind of issues. And I'm happy to see stuff like that because they're conversation starters, and they make people talk about what's happening in our world and look at how we treat other people. We are not a nice country for the most part. The people that, you know, if you turn on the TV, you watch the news, you look at the internet, you look at what they're doing in Congress, and some of these people are just horrible human beings. It would be better if we had a little more compassion for people. And what you're showing is we're all human beings, and you can't, I mean, especially in the wake of the violence we're seeing now against Asian Americans, your book couldn't come at a better time. So I look forward to reading it again. It's Facing the Mountain. Daniel James Brown, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, these are, you know, I go back to school, right? And I'm still kind of mortified by the fact that I never knew that we had Japanese internment camps. We didn't teach it. And I was talking to my husband about that, and he said, yeah, we also didn't teach in school that we, the United States, turned away Holocaust victims. We turned away boatloads of Jews who were fleeing Hitler, who were fleeing the pogroms in Russia, and we turned them away. Then we have not always been this magnanimous, welcoming, easygoing country. We were very Trump-like in terms of calling the others the others. Well, you know what? We're the others. All of us. You know, I still go back to the whole Rick Santorum thing, and the fact that this guy is still collecting a paycheck from CNN frankly makes my blood curdle. Skin curl, whatever the saying is. It makes me angry because he talked about Native Americans as being, you know, nothing. That when the Europeans came here, they founded a nation. No, they didn't. And he said that there was no Native American culture here to speak of, that they founded a country. There's no Native American culture because we erased them. I could say we canceled them. You know, it's the Republicans, and then there's the opposite world faction to what's going on in our world. Everything the Republicans say, there's so much projection going on there. This is what they do. They otherize people. They treat people who they perceive as different from them like shit. They badmouth, you know, look, I can do it with the best of them, but they do it out of a sense of entitlement that they're better than the people that they're talking down about. It's just we need an enlightenment age. We need an age of being better to our fellow people. And maybe it starts with understanding where they came from. And I think our schools don't do a good enough job of that. They really don't. Anyway, with that, it is the weekend. It's just about here. So with that, watch something historical. Watch the movie that he talked about. Now, I can't Justice Mercy. I can't remember what it was called. But find something that's maybe historic, that's entertaining and historic. As much as you need to laugh, which is also important, you need to enjoy life. You need to find things that give you pleasure, whether it's painting or listening to music or watching a movie. Also, learn compassion. We've seem to have lost that art here in this country, and we need to get it back. So anyway, that's that. And I think we're done. Now, I did mention we're going to go into overtime today. So stick around if we're going to say goodbye to the Progressive Voices Network. But again, come over to NicoleSandler.com/listen-live. Or go to my YouTube channel, just YouTube.com/ Nicole Sandler, I believe, will get you there. And if you're interested in hearing my interview with Rick Allen, the drummer of Def Leppard, who's now an artist, it's an interesting conversation. So that's featured on Overtime today. Otherwise, have a great weekend, everyone, and I will see you Monday. All right. Thanks for listening. Be good and be good to yourself. All right. Bye. All right, now we're going into overtime. And if you want to stick around, as I mentioned, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. It's a good thing it's Friday. Earlier today, I had the opportunity to speak with Rick Allen of Def Leppard. Now, I am not a metal person. I'm more of a eclectic, folky, eclectic music. So, I'm familiar with Def Leppard. It's just not my thing. But I know enough about Rick Allen to know this was going to be a fascinating conversation, and I think it was. So enjoy.
Fantastic.
Okay. I'm very excited. Joining us on the line today is Rick Allen, a name familiar to people who are music fans for sure. Rick Allen is the drummer of the band Def Leppard, but he's also an artist. And Rick, it's so nice to meet you. These days, we've never met before, and I come from a music radio background. I did, I know you're in Los Angeles now, right? You live in LA these days?
Yeah, I spend quite a bit of time in Los Angeles, yeah.
Back in the day, like in the 90s, mostly I was out in LA. I worked at KLOS, and then I worked at a couple of other at KSCA. I don't know if you remember it, a very cool AAA station. But that's sort of the musical world I come from, which is adult alternative. So Def Leppard, to be honest with you, was not in high rotation on my home player. However, you know, you guys are world famous. I mean, you're Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductees, and you've sold millions of records. And you, Rick, have a truly unique story in that we all know of you. You're the guy, you joined Def Leppard as a drummer at the age of 15.
That's right. Yes, that's right. Yeah, I answered this. It was an article in the local newspaper, and it said Leppard loses skins, and I think my mum, she called the journalist that wrote the piece in the local paper, and within a couple of days, I met up with Joe and Steve Clark at this local club, and we realized that we'd been to all the same concerts. We were huge music fans, and within a few days of that, I did an audition. The original drummer came back; he wanted his job back, but I guess he spent more time with his girlfriend, and he should have been in rehearsals. But the two of them, a couple of guys played before me, and then I played. And by that time, I'd kind of learned the parts. And there were smiles all around the room when I got to play the songs. And I got the job round about my 15th birthday. So I was, wow. I was stoked. It was fantastic.
And about what year was that? Do you recall?
Yeah, 1978.
Okay, so it was not too many years later that you're world famous. Def Leppard blows up. You're this huge band. You get into a car accident, and you wind up losing your right arm. Is it your right arm or your left arm?
My left arm. Yeah, it was devastating. It was terrible. And I didn't think I was going to be able to go on. But I got so much support from hundreds of thousands of fans all over the world, and my family, you know, they gave me so much love, and the guys, you know, they gave me time to really find myself, and you know, like I say, I didn't particularly want to do it. I got my brother to bring my stereo system into the hospital, and I started tapping my feet on this piece of foam at the bottom of the bed, and just playing along to all the songs that inspired me growing up. And a friend of mine who happened to be in the electronics business, he said, I can make you foot pedals. Huh. I, you know, we can get you playing again. So when I got out of the hospital, my brother drove me over to this guy's store, and he had the drum kit set up. I played for about 5 minutes. I was completely exhausted because I hadn't done anything. I'd been laid up in bed. But that was really the beginning. And I really found the power of the human spirit. And that just elevated me. It just really wanted me to continue. And I realized that I could do it.
That's amazing. So you had a custom, basically a custom drum kit built that allows you to play as usual with your right hand. But you used your left foot or both feet to do the parts that your left hand would play?
That's exactly, yeah. I use my primarily my left leg or my left foot to play a lot of the parts that I used to play with my left arm. And I got really good at it. And that was my primary focus. I would just obsess over playing, and I'd play every single day for hours and hours and hours on end. And before I knew it, I could actually play, you know?
Wow. Obviously, because then you went on to continue with Def Leppard, and that was almost 40 years ago. Right, that's a long time ago. And here you are today. Now, in addition to playing drums, you're also an artist. I noticed this so many years ago that some of my favorite artists, like Joni Mitchell, for instance, I would bemoan the fact, why do the talented people have all the talent? Like Joni Mitchell is this amazing songwriter and artist, and she paints magnificently, and I was sort of, you know, a bit envious. Just an aside, that during the pandemic, while I've been home, I took up painting, and so now, in fact, you can see like a dog portrait behind me. That's one of my paintings. I picked it up at the age of 61. I started painting. So it's never too late to start. When did you get the art bug? When did you turn into not only a musical artist, but a fine artist?
Well, as a kid, I always loved full contact painting, you know, paint everywhere, more paint on the floor and the ceiling than on the paper. And, you know, that it grabbed me. I felt it from that young age. And then I discovered photography, and then, of course, music. And then fast forward, you know, my youngest daughter was born 10 years ago. Oh. I started painting with her. And I kind of got the bug again. My wife encouraged me to show, you know, the work. And I was kind of reluctant at first. But then I realized that I was getting such a positive response from people that I continued. And, you know, one of the pieces that was really significant in my life was I painted Steve Clark. Steve was a guitar player, and sadly we lost him. Hmm. You know, my mom, she keeps in touch with Beryl, his mom, and I sent a photograph of it to my mom, and she shared it with Beryl. And Beryl, you know, she was very complimentary. You know, she said, captured his essence and shed a tear and all that. But it gave me a boost. It gave me the boost I needed to keep going. So, you know, I've developed this wonderful technique of, you know, it's almost like posterizing. You know, when you look at the somebody's face close up, especially the ones that I do, they look like geometric shapes. You don't necessarily see it as a person's face. But then when you stand back from the piece, your mind fills in the blanks. It's a wonderful illusion. So I've really developed that technique. And then more recently, I did Johnny Cash, the original Bad Boy. And I did a couple of pieces of Eddie Van Halen.
In fact, I've got one here that we can show for those watching on a video. So now, oh, cool. This is a photograph, obviously, of Eddie Van Halen. But then you embellish it. What did you do to this piece?
Like, no, this is actually a complete original. So I sketched the photograph, and then I create a grayscale. I create the whites, the grays, the blacks.
Wow.
And, you know, like I say, if you look at it up close, it doesn't necessarily make very much sense. it kind of shapes all put together. Uh-huh. But your mind really fills in the blanks. And, you know, Okay, short story. So 1978, around about the same time that, you know, that I was getting involved with Def Leppard, my best friend that lived a few doors up the street, he calls me, he says, you got to come and listen to this record. So we're sitting up in his bedroom and he puts the first Van Halen record on. And I was completely blown away. It was just incredible. I'd never heard a band like it. It was amazing the way he played guitar. And then a couple of months later, they were coming through Sheffield, our hometown, and they were opening up for Black Sabbath. And quite honestly, Van Halen should have been headlining that show. They were just so good. And then fast forward, I settle in the States in 1991. Who happens to be my neighbor, but Steve Lukather from Toto.
Oh, sure. I know Luke.
Yeah. Right. So Steve, he was, you know, very close with Eddie. And he called me and he said, Rick, we're having a get together. You know, we're going to this restaurant in the Valley. Why don't you come and join us? So I'm like, that's cool. He says, yeah. And Eddie Van Halen's going to be there. So I'd love for you to meet him. So I get to meet Eddie Van Halen. I'm all starstruck, you know, meeting this guy, this icon, this legend, you know, that changed guitar playing forever. And very unassuming, really cool guy. And then, of course, when we lost him, I felt the best way to express my love for him and, you know, and for, you know, really pay homage to him as a person, as a family man, as, you know, just an icon, was to actually paint him. So that was my gift to the world.
Wow. It's lovely. And you have a whole Legends series. I'm guessing that's part of the Legends series.
I recently did Johnny Cash, I just mentioned that, and then Kurt Cobain, who's another person that changed the music industry forever. I believe so too.
So the reason we're talking today, although it's very nice to meet you and talk to you, I'm in South Florida and it turns out that you've got a series of shows coming up next weekend at the Wentworth Galleries. There's one in Boca Raton, there's one in Hollywood, and there's one at the where's the other one in Miami?
On
Las Olas in Fort Lauderdale. The one in Hollywood is actually the Hard Rock, which is now known as the Big Guitar Hotel. I've got mixed feelings about that, but anyway, the Wentworth Gallery is lovely there. I've seen other musicians, other rock stars have had wonderful shows there, and it's been a while since I've been out in the real world, although now, you know, the CDC said if you're fully vaccinated, go back to, you know, go about your life. So this is a good time for your show to happen because a lot of us have been vaccinated and can start going out again. So next weekend,
it starts on the 20th is Las Olas. And then the 21st is the Hard Rock, Hotel in Hollywood. And then the 22nd is Boca Raton.
Right.
What's the name of the mall up
there? It's the Town Center, the Boca Town Center.
Yes.
Which is a lovely mall. But so the series, that the show that you have up there is called Wings of Hope 2021. What is this show about?
Well, I think we all need that at the moment.
Yes, we do. And
as you just suggested, you know, myself and my wife, we got our vaccinations, and, you know, which is an added sort of it's like a safety net, you know. We're still being very cautious. You know, when we go out in public, we're still wearing masks and, you know, being socially distanced and all that stuff. But, you know, this will be the first in-person show I've done since March of last year.
Right.
That was in D.C. at the Wentworth Galleries there. So, you know, it's exciting for me, you know, to be getting out there. I've been at home, busy painting, busy making music, and, you know, everything but being out on tour. So I think right now is a good time for me to be, you know, coming back out and, you know, meeting people again. It's going to be slightly different, but I'm sure people are going to have a great time, and it'll be nice to meet people, you know, under those circumstances, because, you know, I think when I meet people at the art galleries, you know, they tend to they tend to meet me in a different way. It's more intimate, you know?
Yes. Oh, I definitely know. It's not. Yeah. They're meeting you in a different. You're not the rock star here. You're a real person and an artist, right? You're still a rock star, but, you know, it's a different.
Part-time rock star now.
Gotcha. So Wings of Hope. Is that the title of this painting that I'm showing on the screen now?
It is.
Ah, so tell us about this one. This is obviously this is a painting. How do you know, something in your bio intrigued me. It said that to make your art, you utilize drumsticks and rhythm to dictate abstract visuals on canvas.
That was actually when I was working with when I first started this, I was working with a company called Scene 4, and that was actually utilizing light sticks and long exposure photography. That particular piece that you're looking at now, that was actually when I started working with Wentworth Galleries. That's actually a mixed media piece. The original sold actually many years ago, but I wanted to create something different and something that conjured up, as we suggested before, you know, just this whole feeling of hope that there's this silver lining, and, you know, we're going to come out of this, we're going to come out of the pandemic, and, you know, hopefully things are going to get back to normal. And I really want people to feel that sense of, you know, everything's going to be okay.
We got to think that, because the alternative is just, you don't want to go there. I want everyone to know, if you're not in South Florida, you can still see some of Rick's work. You've got a website at rickallen.com. And if you go there, there's different tabs. There's, you know, musician, artist, and some of your work is showing. And for instance, I fell in love with this one. You took the old RCA Victor dog and you gave it, I guess, the Rick Allen treatment here. So this is not. This is a painting. You recreated it and then put the you colored the Victrola in the colors of the British flag.
And actually, the first EP that Def Leppard came out with, we actually had a leopard sitting in front of the player. So I just wanted to put a different spin on it, and sort of bring it back to more of the original, but obviously with the. With the little Union Jack flair on there.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. And there's a whole series on this page. I mean, I can just go through. You've got a number of them displayed here. And your work is just wonderful. So you do a lot with the Union Jack, and you do a lot with the American flag as well. Mobile gas, you take some iconic images and make them your art. So these are very cool. So I just want everyone to know, you can go to rickallen.com under the artist tag, and you'll see some of these beautiful works. I love these.
That's cool. And also, if you go to Wentworth Galleries or wentworthgallery.com, there's, I think, all these same pieces are up there as well. And it'd probably tell you about the upcoming shows as well.
Terrific. So, well, yeah. I will link to that from the description of the video and on my blog when this interview airs. It's so nice to talk to you. Now, are there any plans for Def Leppard to go out and tour again?
I hope so. I'd really like to get back out there again, and I'm sure, you know, thousands of other people would. But I think first and foremost, I think it's up to the promoters, whether that's sports or music or anything where there's large gatherings. I hope, you know, they're thinking about people's safety and well-being. And I think that has to be the primary focus. If it doesn't happen, you know, it will. But again, it has to be about people's safety. So let's hope it happens. And if not, I'll be out there, and I'm sure I'll see people at some point in time.
Definitely. And do you have more art shows lined up, or just these three that next weekend for now?
We're actually in negotiations with for more shows, and I have to get in touch with the gallery and find out which ones, you know, can fit in with my schedule. You know, I play drums with my wife's band, so I have to kind of work in amongst rehearsals and all that kind of stuff. But hopefully, I'll be out there, and I'll be doing a lot more shows.
Terrific! And what's your wife's band? Have we heard it?
Lauren Monroe. Yeah. I mean, she's really talented. She's she's got some fantastic videos up on YouTube. If you go to Lauren Monroe Music, you'll be able to see some of the work that she does.
Terrific. We'll check her out. And your kids, are they musical or are they artistic or both?
Yes. My youngest daughter, she's quite an accomplished pianist at this point. And I think one of the things we love doing is painting together. Nice. And playing music together. So, you know, I know it hasn't been great for a lot of people during lockdown and during the pandemic. But for us, we found a way. And I think just being creative and, you know, spending time with family in a way where, you know, we keep each other amused, you know.
Well, that's all you can do. And there were silver linings in the pandemic. Well, I started painting, for instance, and some families came closer together. And so, you know, I guess we take the life's pleasures and the silver linings where we can get them, especially these days. Rick Allen, it was a pleasure meeting you. Thank you so much. I hope everyone visits rickallen.com. I'll put links up to everything. And maybe we'll see you next weekend at one of these shows. Thank you.
That sounds good. Thank you, Nicole.